Labor and Consumer Affairs will come to order. Welcome, everyone, this morning. We have a full morning. We have seven different groups to testify this morning, so it will be approximately 17 minutes apiece. And if we have time at the end, we do want to have some public testimony, if there is any, and there is a sign-up sheet. There probably will not be a lot of time left, but if there are people here that would like to testify, please feel free to sign up. Okay, our first item this morning, this is Labor Day, a little early. We've invited a number of labor organizations in to tell us what your needs are and what you see as a good direction for Oregon to go in to help our workers. So first on our list, we are very honored to have Commissioner Dan Gardner, Bureau of Labor and Industries. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and with me is Annette Talbot, Deputy Commissioner. And it's very strange sitting on this side of the dais, but anyway. This morning, I just wanted to give you a brief overview of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. To make sure everyone knows what it is that we do, I mean, there is before you a handout which talks about our different divisions. We have the Wage and Hour Division for Wage Enforcement, the Apprenticeship Division. I believe we have about 157 different apprenticeship programs across the state. And we have the Civil Rights Division, as well as a technical assistance unit that goes out and puts on seminars for businesses across the state to let them know basically what are the top 25 or 30 different areas that we have problems in, and to make sure that we stop those problems before they ever happen. It's actually that unit travels all over the state and is in very high demand. We also license farm labor camps, and we set the Little Davis prevailing wage surveys throughout the state. I won't go into vast detail in the interest of time of all the different areas, but they are briefly explained on several of the pages, and some different statistics and some of the contact people within the Bureau of Labor and Industries that are different division heads, etc. I guess to make it easy, we'll just go to the last page, which we'll talk about some of the preliminary lists of legislative issues with the Bureau. Although I'm very well aware you are not a Ways and Means Committee this morning, I think our greatest challenge is probably, like most everyone else, within Ways and Means to see that we can keep the Bureau productive. One thing to remember about the Bureau is that my predecessor, Commissioner Roberts, voluntarily reduced the agency 29% over an 8-year period. And if you total up special sessions 1 through 5, last December's forecast, and the possible failure of Measure 28, and the governor's 0305 budget, will be losing approximately another 20% and be the first state agency reduced at 50% over a 9-year period. So our agency is greatly reduced. One of the things I think that bothers me the most within those reductions is that over the last several years we've closed the offices in Bend, Pendleton, and Coos Bay. Within the governor's recommended budget would be the closure of Medford as well, which would only leave Portland, Salem, and Eugene offices. So that's just something to keep in mind later on as the budget goes through the process. One of my priorities is to start the discussion of adding the commissioner to the Bureau of Labor and Industries to the Economic Development Commission. I think I felt for a long time that on economic development that it should be structured a bit more like the land board, such as you've got the Secretary of State, the governor, and the state treasurer on there, so that economic development is more answerable to our actually elected officials are more answerable to the issues of economic development. So certainly look forward to working with the legislature and our new governor on that issue. Also, one of the issues I've talked about a lot, both during my campaign and since being elected, is adding the Department of Consumer and Business Services Building Codes Division to the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I think this is one that makes an awful lot of sense from a number of aspects. Partly because we have the apprenticeship division where you take a young person through a 1 through 5 year apprenticeship program, and yet if they go into a licensed craft, for instance, like electrical or plumbing, and many of the crafts want to go to registration or licensing, that their continuing education is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Service Building Codes Division. I believe by putting them together, there are efficiencies we can have and have a continuum of education. And also, as I mentioned earlier, you know, by the Bureau having only offices in Portland, Salem, and Eugene, most of the building codes work is in outside in more rural areas. The major metropolitan areas, the cities or counties, do building code enforcement. A building code enforcement through the state is done more in outlying rural areas. And there are some efficiencies we can have in bringing both the enforcement of civil rights, wage and hour, and apprenticeship, along with the building codes in more rural areas to be able to reach farther out of the I-5 corridor. Also on there, on the list, you'll find requiring prevailing wage rate contractors to submit certified payrolls before contracting agencies can pay subcontractors. What we find is those certified payrolls fall behind awful late. They come in very, very late. So this is one way and one, you know, suggestion for an approach so that they come in more rapidly. Certainly if one is waiting for a check, they tend to send them in quicker. Anyway, requiring a prime contractor to provide notice, including PETA, the prevailing wage rates in contracts and subcontracts. Some of these are just housekeeping items. Also clarifying that workers can use the Oregon Family Leave Act and inquire about their leave rights without any retaliation. I believe that was the intent of the law originally, although technically it doesn't say it. So it's more clarifying language. And also to specify that farm workers can take lunch and rest periods as all other workers do is one I intend to introduce. Increasing the maximum civil penalty for contracting with unlicensing, this is farm and forest contractors, from $500 to $2,000. That penalty hasn't been increased in a great number of years, and it adds certainly a greater deterrent to those who are not licensed, and actually helps pay for the enforcement, you know, aspect that we do on going out and seeing that they are licensed. And also to require labor contractors to submit certified payroll to BOLI to provide proof of workers' compensation as a condition of licensure. Again, another housekeeping item that we've been discussing at the Bureau. Actually, and you know, some of the early initiatives that don't require legislative action we've been up to are listed here as well, as far as seeking business input on ways to improve business climate and economic development purposes to enhance efficiencies around the Bureau of Labor and Industries to see that their questions are answered quickly and appropriately. I think one thing is when we get calls in our technical assistance line, it's usually someone needing an immediate answer. They're facing an immediate labor situation and need those answers. And we're trying to improve on how rapidly they get those answers to make sure we're there. And to fill vacancies on the Apprenticeship Council, which have been vacant for some time, to see that we're at full strength there, and develop ways to continue relations and to see that we're working to attract more women and minorities into the apprenticeship side of things. I think one of the things we're looking at is not doing as many compliance reviews on each and every individual apprenticeship program every year, but those that have a higher graduation rate of somewhere above 50% or better, making it every 2 or 3 years so that we can free up staff to help work in those projects to make sure that we're doing things like I've talked with the Superintendent of Public Instruction about having certification for continuing education for counselors in the schools, so they know what the apprenticeship programs are all about, what's available for young people out there, and they can help be advocates for bringing more people into those apprenticeship programs. And we're also looking at expanding into other forms of non-traditional apprenticeship out there to deal with the 21st century and several other things. And I guess rather than ramble on forever, as I've had a reputation on your side of the desk for doing, I'll let you ask any questions you like. Oh, actually, I have, Bill.
Well, thank you very much. I'm sure the committee has a number of questions, because I do.
Sure.
It's quite a lengthy agenda that you've got. I'm interested in education, so you're talking about new fields for apprenticeships. Can you just discuss what some of the new fields might be?
Well, I mean, some of the things we've been looking at are certainly, you know, whether we can work in partnership with some of the community colleges in high-tech areas. We've talked about some with younger people in forestry areas. It's really just an idea in the beginning of its development that we're looking at. Healthcare is another related area to work in partnership, perhaps with some of the high schools that are out there that are doing specified training in healthcare.
Representative Garrard.
Dan, first of all, a lot of us have a lot of confidence that you're going to be a great labor commissioner, and we look forward to your tenure in that position. Like the chairwoman, I'm very interested in the apprenticeship programs because I think that can be a very vital and important role in the economic recovery of our state. So I just encourage you to go forth as you have programmed and planned for, because this is a very vital part of, I think, of our plan in Oregon. So.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Garrard, thank you, and I certainly share your sentiments about the importance of apprenticeship. To the best of my knowledge, I'm the first labor commissioner who's ever graduated from an apprenticeship program, so it's very near and dear to my heart as well.
Good. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Congratulations on undertaking these responsibilities, and it's a good agenda of material to work on. You mentioned that the Bureau of Labor and Industries has contracted to the Willamette Valley, and in your budget that you're proposing, SB 5526, are you planning to reestablish offices in some of the rural cities or outside the valley, and if so, where might those go?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, I guess to clarify a couple of things, too, is we have closed offices in Coos Bay, Pendleton, and Bend over the last several years. We do have outstationed one civil rights person in Pendleton and one apprenticeship person in Bend. And I think if the governor's 03-05 budget goes through, we may outstation one person in the Medford area if we have to close that office as well. I think that if one of the items that I have on that list of putting DCBS building codes into the Bureau of Labor and Industries, over time we could work into outsourcing more into rural communities. But even in the legislation for that, the final consolidation, should the legislature deem it appropriate to do so and the governor sign such legislation, it wouldn't be until the end of 04 that we would actually make the full transition, and it would probably be in the next budget that we would look at more those things in the next biennium.
Thank you.
Representative Kiss.
Commissioner Gardner, thank you for coming here today and taking your time. I know you're busy. My question regarding the apprenticeship programs is, would these programs that you're talking about starting, would they be state-sponsored programs, or would they be independent programs along the lines of some of the independent programs that exist today that are like IBEW and NECN Local 48, which I've had an opportunity to go tour their facility, and they do a great job. Along what lines are you looking to go?
Well, Chair Close, Representative Kitts, when I was part of the legislature, we passed legislation back in, I believe it was 1999. Prior to that time, all apprenticeship programs were technically under the law state agencies and had the protection of the Attorney General's Office for legal advice. And the Bureau of Labor and Industries actually did send in apprenticeship folks to run a program if, in fact, it was, you know, in failing. At that time, we passed legislation to make sure that they all rise or fall on their own and stand on their own and were no longer considered state agencies. I've always supported that concept, and when I was on your side of the desk, voted for such legislation, and I would always want to see that they are private. I certainly partly in partnership with the Bureau in that we do things to help them, you know, to get started, but there's a point they reach very early on after they start where they need to rise or fall on their own.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I have another question. Dan, you have twice on your legislative agenda, you're talking about certified payrolls. requiring the prevailing wage rate contractors to submit certified payrolls. Can you sort of explain what the problem is there?
Well, Chair Close, the problem with certified payrolls is certainly a couple of different things. One is that on prevailing wage projects, there's no central collecting agency for those. If it's a city or county project, you have to go to the city or county to get those certified payrolls. There's also a problem as well with how timely those are sent in and available for the public record. And it's simply our intention to try and make it more of a central clearinghouse, for one thing, for where those certified payrolls can be, and that they're more timely in their availability to the general public.
I see. And has there been a problem in the past with, you talked about before the subs can be paid, has there been a problem with money going out and the problem following where the money's going?
Well, Chair Close, I believe what my understanding and my vast 3 weeks of experience so far has been is that what's happened is that contractors are paid on a regular basis just as the contractual nature goes. However, they're very late in their certified payrolls in sending them into the agency and being available for the general public or for any complaints that may be filed with the Bureau of Labor and Industries to investigate. And it's simply our intention is that in order to have them there a little bit more rapidly, if they know, for instance, that there's a check on the way, if they get them sent in, they would send them in extremely rapidly. I know I would.
Thank you. Other questions, Representative Rosenbaum?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it's great to see you here, Commissioner, and especially because I think you used to sit on this committee in exactly the chair that I'm sitting in now, so it's a rare experience for me to be higher on the dais than you have been. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the problems with implementation of the Oregon Family Leave Law, and on your agenda is clarification of what employees' rights are under that. Is that a category that you're getting a lot of complaints on or problems on? I had heard that anecdotally, and I know in my own workplace there's still a lot of confusion about what are the requirements for people to apply for the leave and be eligible to take it.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, actually, you know, there are several complaints. I think probably the largest point of confusion, if you will, on most people's parts is the difference between the federal family leave law and, you know, the Oregon family leave law, or as we love to call them, OFLIN FEMLA, but way too many acronyms in state government. But anyway, there is a lot of confusion between the two and how you are, when you're eligible for it, how often you how much you have to work prior to being available for family leave, how much notice you have to give in order to take it. There is some confusion on that. And I think a lot of what, I intend to see that the Bureau of Labor and Industries does is make more concentration on the family medical leave within the technical assistance unit so that more employers know exactly what the law is and see if there's more we can do to letting workers know as well what their rights are under the law. Because oftentimes, I think what the complaints that come in are those that aren't covered currently under family medical leave. And, folks who have just hired on and needed a family leave and don't realize how many months they need to work for a particular employer prior to being eligible, those types of things. So I think the more we get the word out to both employers and employees about what the law is, then there'll be less complaints that don't fall within the law itself.
And a follow-up, Chair, thank you. And I was curious to hear you talk a little more about the technical assistance unit and what your plans might be to expand it, because I've always thought it was one of the most valuable functions of the Bureau, and yet it seems like it's largely employers that attend the seminars, although I know some of my coworkers have attended from time to time. But do you have plans to expand that function?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, we're looking at expansion of that function. The one thing to remember about the technical assistance unit is that we do charge for all of those seminars. It is not, the technical assistance unit is self-sustaining, if you will. It does not require any general fund dollars whatsoever. It pays for itself. And I do have some thoughts about expanding it, and actually have talked to our lead worker in that area about it just in the last couple of days. One of the things is to give him some more assistance. Particularly, he does a great job of getting different articles out in a lot of different newspapers across the state, but I think if we had given him some assistance in setting up those types of publications with a lot of other newspapers that reach both employers and employees, and we can expand that way by doing questions and answers, and that reaches a much broader audience than others do. I'd also like to see some of the technical assistance units going on different talk shows as well to answer people's questions so that we can reach, again, a broader audience. You can answer one person's question on a telephone and you've reached one person, but if you answer someone's on the radio, you can reach thousands. And I think it's beneficial for everyone in the state if both employers and employees know what their rights are under the law, and know actually that we also have, which I'll leave with your administrator, free publications for the general public on everything from prevailing wage to family leave to legal hiring practices, civil rights laws, wage and hour laws, etc.
We're giving them free.
Okay, I'm told we do charge for it. I'm sorry about that. We'll work on that. Anyway.
Part of the self-sustaining part.
It's the 3 weeks thing. They still correct me.
Newspaper articles in my local paper that the Bureau has done on, from time to time, informing the public of their rights.
Yeah. Help. Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you so much, Commissioner, for being with us, and we look forward to working with you on these topics that you've discussed with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I look forward to it as well.
Next, we have the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council. Bob Shiprock. Morning, Bob.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bob Shiprock, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council. I'll be brief this morning, before I start my comments as far as what the building trades may be looking at this section, I'd be derelict if I didn't tell the committee and spend a couple seconds on the state of our economy affecting construction work in this state, because it has a direct bearing on probably the biggest issue that you folks will face this year, and that's a budget shortfall. We're running about 20% unemployment, my guess, and it's probably quite close, depending on the trade. I've been through recessions and one depression in this state in construction, been at this business for 30 years, and I see, frankly, no end in sight to the problems regarding construction work in this state. I wanted to share a couple things with you, because there were a couple things that the legislature did last session that I wanted to report on. One was you referred a measure allowing OHSU to sell bonds. That project is about to break ground up on the hill. $400 million worth of construction work sorely needed. Thank you. The second thing the legislature did was a modest bonding proposal for highways, roads, and bridges. ODOT has done a remarkable job getting that work out the door. Mm-hmm. I wish there was more of it. It's beginning to slow down. I'm meeting with Bruce Warner tomorrow to talk about future funding that we may be seeing. However, that's about as bright as I can tie it to that area. High tech is down. Wood products, with the exception of a few projects, one of paper mill is, they're going to put in a tissue machine that's broke ground up there. But other than that, it's pretty slow out there. We thought we'd see a lot of energy work this year. Last session, if you were here and recall, everyone was running around the building talking about their powerhouses they're going to build. None of them have been built. Number have been, frankly, canceled. And the energy market is very uncertain at this point, and I've frankly lost a lot of hope of seeing much energy work going on in the state, particularly with the recent announcement by the Northwest Power Planning Council that we, in fact, may now have a surplus of electricity. So who knows? We'll see. Anyway, I wanted to give you that report. The number one issue that we're going to ask the legislature this year is to look at the economic climate. What can we do? We're going to be participants in helping to reform our permit process. There's a tremendous amount of industrial work slated for the Clatskanie area, up to three large industrial projects, all that have been waiting for 18 months for a water discharge permit. It's a federal permit, so I'm not going to point fingers at the state, but it gives you an idea of some of the things that go on. We'd like to reform that. On a broader note, I'm a member of the Management Labor Advisory Council, or Committee for Workers' Compensation, so any work comp bills that I would guess would come to this committee, you'll probably see me in front of the committee talking about workers' compensation. Again, we want to continue our progress to make that system fairer. Unemployment insurance, we'll probably have a couple small bills trying to liberalize in small areas the UI system. It's not a problem now. It was 3 years ago where we had retired members because we had so much work at the time out working. There's a quirk in the law that, however, when they're laid off, they cannot draw unemployment benefits. I didn't know that. It was brought to my attention, and I'll be working with the Employment Department on that issue. One thing I will say, and Dan Gardner touched on it, we do apprenticeship. That is what the building trades does. That is our training program. You folks should know that you live in a state that probably has the finest apprenticeship and training programs in the country. In the country, we turn out extraordinarily well trained apprentices for the employers and owners of this state. In relation to that, we will vigorously resist any attempts to lower the standards in this state on apprenticeship. We're not going to go backwards, and I hope that that doesn't come up this session. We'll be supporting some kind of a fuel tax. I can't tell you what it's going to be, but it's risen to the level now, I'm sure you're all aware, the bridges, particularly the bridges in this system, are to the point where it will affect commerce in this state. And when we start diverting truck traffic through little cities, not getting goods delivered, and shutting down bridges, it's unacceptable. And I hope that this legislature can come together and do the right thing to put some money into our road system, and particularly for bridge repair. I've talked about the permit process. We've got some ideas about that. We'll be working with you and business to work on that process. And last but not least, I'm going to be working with the Building Codes Division. One step that I think is necessary in this state to continue the high level of expertise that we have is to work more closely with the state to certify certain craft workers so that the public is assured that they know what they're doing. There's a crisis right now. Anything to do with water, moisture, mold, big crisis going on. And it's frankly because the stuff is implied improperly. Adopt new codes so that we can ensure commerce in this state, that when we build them a building, it's going to be well built and last. I'll stop.
Questions? Wow, you have really given us a lot of information quickly. I want to ask you about these Clatskanie plants. What type of plants are these?
There's three plants proposed, all in the Clatskanie area. There's a place called Port Westward. Portland General Electric has a generating plant out there now. On that property, a company called Caskey Grain is proposing to build an ethanol plant using grain. I'm told it'll be brought in from the Midwest. California has banned an additive in gasoline, and they're intending to use ethanol to replace it. It's about a $200 million plant. Portland General Electric is looking at a gas-fired turbine plant, as is a group of
directors led by Brett Wilcox, who owns the aluminum companies, also looking at a gas-fired turbine plant as well. All contingent on the discharge permit. And
that would be through EPA? Is that an EPA permit?
We're expecting EPA to grant the permit, I'm told, at the end of this month. Then we'll probably go to court.
Representative Kibbs.
Got a comment, first of all, a question, and then a follow-up question, if I might. First of all, Bob, I would like to thank you on behalf of myself and my colleagues that are not familiar with you, my freshman colleagues who may be watching on the monitor as well. Your honesty, your integrity over this process is very much appreciated. I would recommend your word to anybody listening, as well as members of this committee. I have found Bob to be nothing but honorable, and I thank you for that. That's my comment. Second of all, you mentioned the permit process. What specifically, I know we hear a lot about that, you know, as being such a cumbersome process. Any ideas specifically that you're working on that we as a committee could look at to streamline this process?
Absolutely.
And make it more viable for our workers out there?
In fact, Mark Long with Building Codes Division has started on that project. I would hope that maybe he'd at least the chair would talk to him about it. He's got some great ideas. Frankly, we're looking at giving the state the ability to supersite projects. The state does it for their own work. Why not for a large industrial project, for instance? I've always been curious about why the state, when we site a prison, we don't go through the local planning process. We just, because we know what we're expecting. There's a big need for more industrial land. There's a question as to whether local government should even be doing plan reviews. That's another thing that holds up the process. When you've got drawings that have been designed and stamped by engineers and licensed architects, why are we going through a three-month process to go over this again? That's some of the ideas. And frankly, you've got such a balkanization of planning departments in this state, a couple hundred. Every town now has their own little planning department. And frankly, to be honest with you, I'm not sure that we need that many, and I'm curious as to why we have so many, and I think, frankly, it's there to develop some revenue. And needs to be looked at.
Follow up. And it's actually not a follow-up, so I apologize for that question. You also mentioned this ethanol plant in Klaskin, and I think it's a great idea anytime we can create jobs. Mm-hmm. I would like if you or whomever could look at the possibility of not simply importing grain from the Midwest, but looking to use our own grain here in Oregon and keep our farmers at work. If that's a possibility, that's something I'd like to look at.
That, I understand, is a very big issue with the Oregon Farm Bureau. I've been told that. I should mention, too, Madam Chair, that one thing since we were talking about some of the large industrial plants, I just want to get it on this committee's radar screen that when the government gives tax breaks, enterprise zones, pollution control tax breaks, I think it's really a bad situation, and it's happened in Oregon, where companies have gotten these tax breaks and then have imported their workers into the state to build the facilities. I think it's a very bad situation. I would implore you folks that if we give out tax breaks to stimulate the economy, to encourage business in this state, that they have the decency to turn around and say, yeah, and this is for Oregon workers too. It's our money. We're taxpayers too.
That's right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Further questions? Representative Gerard.
Bob, I have some great news for you on the energy front.
I could use some.
We are building a new power plant in Klamath County, which
I'm
I know
aware of that. I don't know when we're going to break ground on it, so.
Other questions? Representative Rosenblatt. Thank you. Good morning, Bob. I know that the last time we met in regular session, we were still in pretty boom times in your industry, but I'm curious if you can tell us a little bit about what the trend's been in terms of unemployment. Where is it at right now? Is it getting worse? Are you seeing it?
No, this is getting worse, and I'll tell you what has happened. It's probably a good thing. The accounting scandals crippled our industry because there's no money. The interest rates are extraordinarily low right now, but the banks won't loan any money because of the accounting problems. They're very leery to lend money. If you want to build a building, the pre-lease requirements are extraordinarily high. I mean, you have to essentially have it leased out before you break ground. The large industrial owners, heavily in debt already, and frankly, I don't blame the bankers for we're not going to give you another $1 billion since we don't know where it's going. So those things have all happened, all met at the same time, this critical juncture where that's what's going on. And the lack of public investment at the federal level as well. It's all been diverted to other things now.
And I know in the past we've been in a situation where we were actually importing workers into Oregon.
Absolutely.
From other states or even other countries. What's happening now? Are people leaving the state to find work? Or?
Yes, they are. 4 years ago we had about 100, my guess was about 115% employment. We were actually bringing, well, it's one of the beauties of organized building trade labor is that we have members all over the United States and Canada, and when one area needs workers, they can bring them in. Conversely, when we're out of work, we can travel to where the jobs are at. That's happening, but the bad news is this economy throughout the country is not great, but there is an outflow right now of workers trying to seek employment in other states. Yes.
Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for coming, Mr. Shipback. I don't hear anyone clamoring to create dental and medical schools that would train doctors and dentists at a minimum level. And I just want to tell you that I totally support your efforts to maintain the highest of standards of apprenticeship here in the state of Oregon, because I've worked with these men and women, and they are professionals. And we drive on their roads and over their bridges and work and live in their buildings every day, and I absolutely support you 100% on that. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you so much. Excellent testimony, very helpful, and I hope you will be back to further assist us.
I hope so, too. Thank you very much.
Next, we have the National Electrical Contractors Association, and Tim, forgive me if I slaughter your name. Is it
Gothier?
Gothier. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Tim Gothier, and I'm the executive manager of the Oregon Columbia Chapter, National Electrical Contractors Association. I make that distinction because we have three chapters in the state of Oregon, and amongst those three chapters, we represent approximately 400 union electrical contractors that employ about 5,000 electricians. We are pretty much self-sustaining in our industry in the fact that we have our own health and welfare company. It's almost 50 years old. We have our own pension plans, both defined contribution and defined pension that we're dealing with now amongst everybody else in their pension plans, and do provide with our partners, the IBEW, apprenticeship training, continuing education training for our journeymen, as well as management training for our management personnel. I think a little highlight, since Bob mentioned some issues about employment and what's happening, 2002 was a year not of great numbers for us. We were off 32% in employment from 2 years prior. We have to go back 8 years to 1995 to see comparable employment numbers in our trade. And as Bob mentioned, the expectation for 2003 is not much greater. Similar issues, a lot of contractors have jobs that are sitting waiting for financing because of the economy and the uncertainty of what's going to happen over the course of the next few years. We do have several items that we will be dealing with this next year. Although we are very strong advocates, not only of our state apprenticeship program and as well we'll defend that program as strongly as we possibly can, but also in licensing and permitting, inspection, and compliance with the laws. Our contractors and our partners in labor are very supportive of the state programs and local authority. However, we would say, as well as Bob, that there are areas to look at for streamlining. We have also been in discussions with Mark Long about the task force for streamlining for construction and siting projects in the state. But we also believe that there's some issues that could be streamlined within our own electrical industry. Whereas many of the local authorities in the states have websites and information, there's no access to taking a permit over or via the internet at this point. The state of Washington does allow that, and it has been able to stimulate and move projects quickly, whereas at times we have to wait for the proper paper to be handled through the mail to the right person to get approval, to cash the check, to get it back to the contractor before they can actually start the electrical work, where the general contractor and owner are wondering why the electrician's not on the job. So we would really like to look at streamlining the possibility of starting projects and permitting via the internet. The other issues that we have in regard to CCB, the Construction Contractors Board, the Building Codes Division, the Bureau of Labor and Industries, OSHA, workers' compensation, is in our industry, we're having to deal with four or five different agencies for those programs that I just mentioned. What would be beneficial would be to have those programs centralized under one agency, so that it's easy access. The bureaucrats that work within those programs work together rather than in various other agencies where we're having to go from building to building and program to program to accomplish basically the same generic issues that we deal with in the construction industry. And again, also in CCB, we would like to start specializing in identifying the contractors by their specialization out in the industry, so we know who is working out there and under what types of licensing, by whether identification on vehicles or their licenses to have an E for electrical or a P for plumbing or something to that effect. Also, we are looking to have more representation on the Construction Contractors Board by specialty contractors and possibly a tradesperson as well. Also, code adoption is something that is very hot right now in the Building Codes Agency. Whether or not we stick with the new I-codes or the NFPA building codes, I would like to say that the one thing that we have always been supportive of are consensus-based codes where everybody is involved in the code-making process. For example, the National Electrical Code through the National Fire Protection Agency has a code-making process that involves labor, management, manufacturers, inspectors, building officials. Everybody comes to the table not only with a voice but a vote. Other processes are closed. You might be able to give testimony, but you are not part of the decision-making process. We are very strong advocates of a consensus-based code adoption process and would look for those types of things to happen in state government as well.
Tim, would there be, are you working on legislation? Do you have for that?
Not at this point, because the code, a lot of the codes are adopted through various boards, and they have their own way of adopting their boards, and we would like to work with those agencies and boards to make sure that it happens the proper way. If something happens or we can't have that happen, then yes, we would look for some type of legislation. The Electrical Board currently adopts the National Electrical Code for commercial and industrial work. We would also like to see them adopt the Electrical Code for the 1 and 2 family, which currently is under the Structural Board with no electrical expertise on their board. And also, as mentioned earlier by Bob, we would obviously be looking at any type of economic stimulus for the construction industry, whether it be for roads and transportation and bridges, other superstructure work that must be done. And we don't just come here saying we would like to do that. We in the building trades industry, contractors, and our partners in labor put our money where our mouth is. We are constantly looking at projects through our pension plans and funding them. Matter of fact, the first phase of the McAdam project up in Portland is being looked at right now by several pension plans and funding the first $200 million to get it started. So we don't just sit back and ask. We also put our money where it's needed and help to stimulate the economy ourselves. And that's the extent of my comments. Madam Chair, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Well, I'm interested in the state of Washington one-upping us here on the permit process. I think we're going to look into that. Do they pay over the internet too? Do they ever have to go into an actual office?
That's one way you can do it, but they set up accounts with the contractors, so they have a bank account and or a credit card, and then they can just tap into that account and process the permit via the internet. Now, this is electrical. I don't know of any other permitting processes in the state of Washington. I'm only familiar with the electrical, and that is available for state projects.
State projects
right.
only.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Or state jurisdiction, I should say, not just state-funded projects, all, but only in the jurisdiction that the state inspects.
Okay.
We're actually building a website right now for our members that will tie links to every local authority for inspection and give the information for both their inspectors as well as their permit application. But as I mentioned, at this point, nobody has the ability of taking a permit out over the internet. But we were building a one-stop shop for all of our contractors, because right now you'd have to hit every city's website to get the information through various links to get to the electrical part, and this will go directly to those.
And might it streamline the form process, where every county probably has a different looking form? I imagine if it's on the internet, there'd be one for the whole.
It would be like that. The electrical industry worked over the years to have the same form and the same calculation method. It might end up with a different number, but we have been able to do that over the last 15 years of dealing with the different state and local authorities, and it's been very helpful.
Questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tim, I don't know if you were in the room when the Labor Commissioner was testifying earlier, but you talked about the multitude of agencies that you now have to deal with and how it would be helpful to have that streamlined. Some, are you supportive of the proposal to look at moving the Building Codes Agency into the Bureau of Labor and Industry, or have you taken a position on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, we are supportive of that change. Yes, we would like to have it centralized once again. Many years ago it was, and it would be nice to have that all back again.
Thanks. Further questions? Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, thank you for coming. I have a question about, you'd mentioned the reinvestment of pension plans, creating jobs and hoping for return. The McAdam project, this is the first one, or are there other projects that you've chosen to invest in and seen a return and jobs created as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, we have approximately $1 billion of equity in buildings throughout the state of Oregon as it is right now. Not that we own the entire amount of it, but we have been working through our pension plans over the last 20 years and putting in place, and we have there's quite a few employers in this state that are tenants of ours, including Nike and Intel and others.
Excellent.
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Next, we have the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, Ron Murray. And before Ron starts, I would just say we had previously thought we'd be discussing minimum wage today, but we changed the agenda. So if you're here on that issue, that will be coming up at a later time.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ron Murray, and I'm actually with the United Association of Plumbers and Steamfitters Local 290, and I am a plumber by trade. So I represent the labor portion and not the contractors, the PMCA, just for clarification. To tell you a little bit about Local 290, we are the largest pipe trades organization west of the Mississippi River, and we represent approximately 4,300 members in the state of Oregon, Southwest Washington, and Northern California. Our members are licensed plumbers, licensed under the Building Code Division. They are also steam fitters and pipe fitters who receive a license under the Boiler Board, and we also have a very active presence in the Port of Portland and in the Oregon shipyards, and that's kind of a waning industry that we're looking to revive the best we can. Certainly with the Homeland Defense issue, we see the Port of Portland as not being tremendously active, or our port, in defensive issues, and I realize that's a federal issue, but we're working very closely to assure that these people can retain their skills in case they're needed. Our big focus is on apprenticeship and training. As if you can regress many years ago when you were in high school, you learned that apprenticeship programs originally originated in Europe. Our apprenticeship process is 5 years in length, and we've basically built upon that structure. The anomaly that has now occurred is that we have a program with Germany where they send their instructors to the United States, to our training center up in Tualatin, to learn the techniques that we have developed to improve upon the training process. We have 13 training centers throughout the state of Oregon. All of our apprentices pay for their own education with our contractor association. We receive basically no state or federal funding for our apprenticeship training. It is all self-funded. One of the things I think that is most important, though, is that we don't stop the training program when an apprentice graduates. We actually look at that as just the very beginning of our training, and that our training goes throughout our career with a journeyman training program. To give an example of programs that we have developed, the medical gas technology program, residential fire sprinkler training. Oregon, as you may be well be aware, is the leader in residential fire sprinkler training in the world. And that program was actually developed at Local 290, working with several agencies, the National Fire Protection Association, and our partners, the Oregon Fire Service, whether it's the Oregon State Fire Marshal's Office or local fire jurisdictions. And we have been able to develop technology for the installation of these systems that makes them very, very efficient. The other program that we are very heavily involved in our journeyman training program is in the high-tech industry. We have a tremendous investment in our training centers in specialized welding programs, dealing with hazardous materials, and so forth and so on. Because we have the expertise in our training centers and with our journeymen, we can immediately respond to the needs of the high-tech industry when a new process is called for or a new technology is needed. And here again, we don't go to outside sources for that funding. That is paid for by our members and our member contractors, so our bargaining agreements. One of the things that we've done in our apprenticeship program is as we're beginning to promote a process called Helmets to Hard Hats, and it's working with our armed forces to allow discharged veterans from our military service to have an easier entrance to get into the building trades. We know that these people have acquired a great number of skills in the military service. They serve their country. That we know they work hard. We know that they're team players, and we think that we have a responsibility to them to try to ease the transition into civilian life. The other thing that we do is we find that many people that come to our apprenticeship programs simply aren't qualified to enter our program. And what we are doing now, and I don't like to use the term remedial, but we are offering classes that we believe that the traditional sources of math and reading education have not responded to our needs. We have a very, very technologically based industry, and so now we are actually offering, for example, algebra classes as a pre-apprentice step so we can get the highest quality of applicant and basically as well open our application process to those that might not be qualified. So we're actually going out and kind of taking that extra step. One of the things I think I'm fond about talking about is the partnerships that we have, partnerships, as I've already mentioned, with the Oregon State Fire Service. We try to offer all of our classes, medical gas, hazardous material, ammonia classes, to the fire service at no charge. And it really is a great partnership program. To give you an example, in rural areas of the state, anhydrous ammonia is used as a refrigerant. And many small volunteer fire departments or even rural career departments are not familiar with how to deal with some of the hazardous material responses that could occur. So what we've done is actually brought them into our training centers and trained them on how to adequately respond to some of these disasters that could occur in their own communities. I sit on the Governor's Fire Service Policy Council as well as the Tri-County Industry Advisory Council in the state of Oregon. So we're up in Portland. So we are very, very involved in code compliance, code consistency, and the streamlining process. And you will see from us a bill this session which will have no net cost to the state of Oregon for the regulatory streamlining process. You will also see a bill to consolidate some of the services that are provided by the state of Oregon. As a licensed plumber, you could actually have to have a license from Building Code Division, CCB, and other agencies throughout the state of Oregon just to do business. One of them would be the Health Division as well. As far as the code issue is concerned, Oregon has the Uniform Plumbing Code. It's a code that has worked very well for us. I would share the sentiment of Mr. Gauthier from NECA that we are supportive of a consensus code process. And now is certainly not the time for the state of Oregon to take a wild venture and see if a new code that's untried and untested would work for us. The governor of the state of Washington last week issued an edict, and he stated that with the economy in the state in the state that it is, in the state of Washington, that they certainly will not be looking at any new codes in the near future. So we certainly hope that we would kind of piggyback upon that philosophy. With that, I think I'll probably close, and if I could answer any questions, I would be more than happy to.
Well, thank you very much. That's just a great deal of helpful information for us, and it looks like you're doing a wonderful job. I want to congratulate you on all your training that you're doing, and we appreciate that you're not charging some of our fire departments helping them out. However, one of the thing, the ideas that's being discussed this session is research and development and how that could maybe be an industry in Oregon in a way that we would have something we could be selling, a service that would help us, you know, compete overseas, that being something they wouldn't be as good at. And you mentioned bringing German people here and training them. And I'm wondering if you're able to profit from the research and development that you've done at all.
Madam Chair, we believe that we have. To give you an idea, the investment we have in the residential fire sprinkler program, I believe that we got into it somewhat philanthropically in nature. And my background as well is in the fire service. I've served 8 years as a fire chief in the state of Oregon, and I'm a licensed fire medic. And we do tend to integrate that in some of our training programs, believe it or not. One of the things that our parent organization has invested in, our United Association, is biopharmaceutical research. And we actually have a training program currently in place that we could start at a moment's notice. We know that the legislature is involved in that. For us, as an entity, as an organization, we do not receive any economic benefit, so to speak, from a training program. All the benefit goes to our members and to the industry as a whole. We are, as you're probably aware, a nonprofit organization, and we don't seek to make a profit, but basically to serve our members. And so the higher trained that our members are, certainly the better I think the economy of the state of Oregon will prosper. One of the things that we do see is that when we have individuals that become licensed in their trades, that people begin to pick at that license, and they go, well, I can do that little tiny bit of a job. You don't have to be a master plumber to do that, or you don't have to be a pressure vessel licensee to work on this part of the vessel. So there's a continual attack on the licensing process. When we talk about pressure vessels, and I never know how much to tell a legislator, you know, I don't want to belittle and say, do you know what a pressure vessel is? But to give you an idea,
no.
if you remember when back when you were home and Mom would put the little pressure cooker on the stove and it had that little thing that would wiggle on top, you know, and she'd always warn you, don't touch it, it's going to explode. Or if we stop to think that when you go to the gas station and fill your tires with air, which I know we don't do that anymore, I guess we go to Leshaw, but there's only 35 pounds of pressure in that tire, and you know what it's like to have a blowout and the big bang and the explosion and the disastrous results. Think about a pressure vessel, a boiler that's half the size of this room, that's operating under 100 times more pressure than the tires on your car. Think of the disastrous consequences if you don't have a licensed pressure vessel installer working on that device. Almost all of the issues that we face in our industry are health and safety issues. So I don't know if I answered your question. I sure rambled.
I think you have. I didn't realize you were a nonprofit.
Yes, ma'am.
Further questions? Mary. Representative Gallegos.
That's okay. I know who you're talking to. I appreciate you coming today, and maybe I have more of a commentary. A common theme seems to be apprenticeship programs, and obviously they've evolved over the years. I do understand pressure vessels, master plumbers. My father was a plumber and made journeyman at 16 because he apprenticed with his father. Seemed to be the family trade. And obviously technology has changed over the many years since he has done that. But we have my school district has one of the highest dropout rates in the state. Clearly, apprenticeship programs hopefully will be the key to many folks seeing that there's an opportunity not to drop out, but that there's alternatives to maybe the having to go to college and become a computer science engineer. Do you see, you know, your apprenticeship growing programs growing, a need for it to grow, evolve? Do you have plans to expand it?
Through the chair, Representative Gallegos, yes, in fact, you've actually hit upon a topic that is a very high priority for us. As I mentioned, we believe that many traditional forms of education are not preparing the students to enter our apprenticeship programs. Our programs are very technical in nature, as well as lengthy. The individual, and first of all, we have a very high outreach program, very strong outreach program to bring women to the trades. But you work 8 hours a day, then you go to school 6 hours at night, or 6 hours a week, excuse me, two sessions of 3 hours apiece. So there's a tremendous investment that we have in an apprentice and to make sure that they're successful in the program. What we have instituted now here again is a program for people that might not qualify under our normal apprenticeship standards, that we will bring them in and teach them some of the basic math skills that will be necessary for them to be successful. And this is prior to them ever even being involved in the state apprenticeship program. Another program that we've just come out with is a residential HVAC program that will be pay a living wage, a family wage, but not at the same level as our building trade program will. It will not be what we would call a registered apprenticeship program, but it will be a training program that was inspired strictly at our local. It's more of an entry-level type of a journeyman program, so we can hopefully attract people that would not typically be looking at an apprenticeship program. We still believe our standards will be just as high. The program will be perhaps half as long in duration, so these people can get into the field more quickly, but they will still have then the opportunity with this training and with this education to go into the full-scale building trades journeyman program. So yes, we are attempting to work with other students and other potential apprentices.
Further questions?
Madam Chair, I had a related question to Representative Gallegos' question. It sounds like you're doing great work with trying to bring people who might not otherwise qualify, but I'm curious, are you seeing a deterioration in the readiness to learn in basic literacy skills and things that we would expect our schools to be providing as part of basic education?
Through the chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I think that has been a long-standing complaint, certainly of our industry. All that we ask is that the individuals that apply for our program have basic skills, basic reading and writing skills, and basic math skills. And it's actually quite a hurdle for us. I think that we also see, and we have a philosophy, I think probably every industry in the world has the philosophy that you want the best and the brightest, but we actually believe that we adhere to it. And we will not degrade our admission or entrance requirements. And so we expect the student to rise and meet those requirements. But we're willing to help them do that. I think that many times our traditional education folks still look at us as a blue-collar trade, and so some of the best and brightest students aren't perhaps directed toward us. and we want to change that. And we have outreach methods to change that, and we go to the schools. We pay family wage. We have family wage jobs, and we believe that we can be very, very attractive to students. But yes, there is somewhat of a problem with us getting students that meet our qualifications, and they're pretty minimal, actually.
And a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
Are you required to have a high school diploma or GED in order to get into a plumbing apprenticeship?
Through the chair, Madam Representative Rosenbaum, I don't work in a training center. We did have that requirement. My understanding is now the way the law is written, you cannot actually state that you're required to have like a high school education or so forth and so on. That's kind of a technicality, but that's what we shoot for, certainly.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony, Ron, and we look forward to working with you on these issues.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee.
Thank you. Next, we have Oregon AFL CIO, Tim Nesbitt.
Good morning, Chair Close, members of the committee. Lots of paper coming your way. Try and get it all in front of you early in the session.
Okay.
I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and thank you for the opportunity to address you this morning about labor's view of working Oregon and the state of our economy and what we can do to improve both our economy and the standard of living for workers in Oregon. In the packet, well, first let me say, by way of introduction, I haven't met all of you before, the unions of the AFL-CIO in Oregon represent 180,000 workers in our state, of whom about 110,000 work in the private sector. And our colleagues in other unions and associations represent another 80,000 workers in Oregon. So one of every six workers in Oregon is represented by a union and enjoys the benefits and job protections of a negotiated contract. Also, voters in union households vote in greater proportions than voters in non-union households, regularly accounting for 23% to 25% of votes cast in our elections. So we're pleased to say that our members are well-educated on public policy issues. We work hard to make that happen, and engaged actively in our democracy and in our elections. Finally, I also want to point out to you that in the most recent of what's become an annual survey conducted by the AFL-CIO nationally, fully half of all workers report that who don't have a union report that they would vote for a union, would vote to join a union if they had the opportunity. That's the highest level since the early 80s. And many of these workers look to our labor movement as their voice on issues like minimum wage, job training, unemployment benefits, and health care. So we feel we have a responsibility both to our members to represent them and also to workers generally to speak for them in arenas like this. That in mind, I want to just show you, without walking page by page through all these materials, what we're providing. On the left-hand side, a study recently published by the Oregon Center for Public Policy entitled Boom, Bust, and Beyond, which we think is an excellent overview of our economy and of the state of workers in Oregon. And we recommend this to you for your bedtime reading. I have it next to my bedside. Also, just to tell you that a lot of the facts and figures we present, we've organized in our action plan, which is also here, come from this document. In your packet, a lot more background material behind our action plan, information from Washington State on our tax structure, detailed charts on the healthcare cost crisis affecting all of us as workers and businesses. And behind that, the most recent study we have that really answers the question of what's a living wage job is almost 2 years old, but I attached that because there's not been an update since 2001. But Back then, you'll see that the living wage job, depending on family size, was somewhere between $11 and $18 per hour. And this document also answers, I think, all the questions about how do you calculate a living wage and why it's important. But I do want to call your attention most specifically to our action plan for good jobs and better government, which we've distributed to all members of the legislature. Perhaps I can start by reacting to some of the testimony I heard Monday morning at this committee, which at times, and I don't want to be dismissive or disrespectful, but at times it sounded to me like we were talking about Lake Wobegon, where all the businesses are small and all the taxpayers are above average. But really, thinking beyond that, when Mr. Blackledge testified about the impact on Oregon of small employers, he talked about 58% of our jobs coming from that sector. But he also, if you look at his documents, defined the small business as one with fewer than 500 employees. And in fact, I think that's really a mid-sized business. And most of our employers, where we represent workers on the job, probably have fewer than 500 employees. And I think in any category, small, medium, or large, what is important to understand is that if you're a good employer, you're able to provide good jobs with good benefits and still be competitive in our economy. So I think the question is how, for any employer, you can encourage fair employment practices and sustain family wage jobs. And then there's that question that keeps coming up about tax burden. I would submit, and I would call your attention to the one-pager we have here on the right-hand side of your packet, that taxes are the least of our problem, currently. This is a study done by a business group in Washington State. They do it every couple of years. It's their competitiveness red book. I'm trying to get more copies of this book because it has a lot of data that I'd like to share with you on other matters besides taxes. But this shows that Oregon has the lowest of the 11 western states, the lowest tax share for business of any of those states, and the lowest absolute tax burden for business of any of those states. So I think what is important to keep in mind is that if we become a low-tax state, it's not because taxes have declined significantly for working families. There's a lot of information in our action plan which document that problem. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it now because you're not the revenue committee, but I think it's important to understand that the tax burden over the last 12 years has declined a lot more on the business side than it has on the individual side. And individuals and working families are paying a lot more to support our services than is the case with business taxpayers. We want to spend most of our, we want to focus actually in what we're presenting this morning, however, on the situation of working families, where, you know, you can look at some of the data on personal income and see gains made in the 1990s, and some of those gains were significant. But when you look further, you'll see that a lot of those gains come because of workers working longer hours. In fact, the data in the study Boom Bust and Beyond shows that the typical married couple family in Oregon increased its annual hours of work by 330 hours in the 1990s. And that's an increase of 9.4%. But the median income of that household, a four-person family, rose only 6.5% during the same period. So in our analysis, we're seeing workers working harder and longer and smarter, but not necessarily getting an equal return for their effort. The problems are particularly evident among low-wage workers. A study released several years ago by the Conference Board, which is a national business research group, showed a higher percentage, and this was before we had turned into recession, a higher percentage of full-time workers living below the poverty line in the U.S. than at any time in the last 25 years. And in addition to that issue of wages, we have continuing concerns about erosion of health benefit coverage in our workforce and the erosion of retirement coverage as well. By the way, that Conference Board study attributed the increase in the working poor to the decline of unions, the erosion of the minimum wage, and the effects of free trade. So
We have developed for your consideration 9 points. Well, I wasn't trying to outdo Mr. Buttrick's 54 points for AOI. He and I have joked about that. I can support two of his, and if we can support two of ours, I think it would be a good trade-off.
I think you have more pages than they did, though.
Okay. But first of all, and I think there's a lot here that we can agree with AOI, and that's we need to create more family wage jobs. I want to just point out to you that where job losses have been most serious in our economy over the last several years has been in the manufacturing sector as well as in the construction sector, and both of those are the biggest sources of family wage jobs. And especially in the manufacturing sector, very hard to replace even when we get to recovery. We want to pay particular attention to that. We're, as you know, as you're concerned, I'm sure, with the erosion of our transportation infrastructure, there's obviously a need to be addressed there, one which we can address with initiatives that create jobs at the same time, in the short term, at the same time that they fix the problem in the long term to make their economy more competitive in the future. We've learned the hard way that catering to new industries can successfully diversify our economy, as was the case with high tech, but it doesn't necessarily insulate our economy from the forces beyond our immediate control, like national business cycles and the effects of globalization. Again, that's that primary cause for the loss of so much of our manufacturing jobs. So I was a participant at the Business Summit in early December and appreciated a lot of the analysis of the economy that was presented, but I think we need to look beyond the so-called knowledge-based segment of our economy, which is at most maybe 15% of our workforce, and look at helping the industries with a record of success in Oregon remain successful, like specialty metals and paper manufacturing, big sources of family wage jobs in Oregon, playing to our natural strength, like timber and wood products manufacturing, and working to maintain our competitive advantages. It used to be we had a competitive advantage in energy costs. No longer. We need to regain that. And perhaps looking at the potential for renewable energy sources like wind and geothermal power will help us regain that at the same time, creating good-paying jobs. Specific proposals to call your attention to in this category, to accelerate the rebuilding of our bridges and roads. Now, whether we do that with extra pennies in the gas tax or a vehicle registration fee increase, we're supportive of either approach. The important thing is to get this job done, get it done in the near term, put people to work repairing our infrastructure, and as I said, paving, literally, the way for economic recovery in the future. Completing the deepening of the Columbia River Channel, 59,000 jobs in Oregon and Washington are sustained by commerce on that river system. Facilitated jobs in the woods program, which you'll be hearing about more from the Carpenters Union and the woodworkers unions that we work in concert with to look at ways in which to create year-round jobs involving the protection of watersheds and sustainable forestry practices on state forest lands. Let's think, too, about how we kind of make the most of some of the energy settlement money that's now coming to Oregon. There was a settlement with the Williams companies that produced $15 million, $7 million of it payable this month. Other settlements are likely to come down the pike soon with other companies. And remember, it was high energy costs that forced the closure of so many of our manufacturing plants, thinking of Adafina Chemical in North Portland and some of our steel and aluminum facilities. We should be looking at a potential use of some of those funds to help address economic recovery or revitalization in the industries that were hard hit or even put out of business in some cases by high energy costs and the workers who were dislocated. Perhaps that's a source of more funding for worker retraining. And as I think AOI and all those who testified before you Monday morning would agree, we need to encourage the branding and marketing of Oregon products and establish first source policies for the purchase of Oregon products and services. It's ironic that last summer we learned that Oregon is no longer purchasing its license plates from a manufacturing firm in Portland. Instead, it went out of state, out of country, to Canada when it rebid that contract last year. And we lost not a lot, but we lost a significant number of jobs. I think it was several dozen jobs in Portland because of that. And then finally, as you've heard Bob Shiprack speak to, we need to ensure an adequate supply of appropriate land for industrial development. I want to spend a little time as well talking to you about the problem with health care costs.
Before you go on, Tim, would like you to just, I'd like to ask you sort of a tough question. A number of things that you have here you know, the deepening of the channel and the helping of the wood products industry comes right up against environmentalists in the courts. The governor has said that he supports these things, but that he will not change any environmental laws. So it seems to me we have a problem here. How do you recommend we address that?
Chair Close, I guess I would need to hear more specifically which law is a barrier to accomplish any of these things. Let me address the last point first, ensuring an adequate supply of appropriate land for industrial development. I think actually the newly elected president of Metro, Mr. Bragdon, is supportive of that. I think we do have some conflicts with our friends in the environmental community on that, but I think it gets down to appropriate land, and we need to work through that. Again, when it comes to the deepening of the Columbia River Channel, we don't believe that should come at high cost to our environment by any means, and so it's again a matter of finding the right balance.
It does change the environment, doesn't it?
I don't know that it requires a change of any laws. I haven't heard the case made that it does.
Okay.
So I'd rather reserve judgment until I hear what the barrier is that we might have to change either statutorily or in our rules.
Okay.
If I can, without taking a lot more of your time, I do want to call your attention to this crisis of healthcare costs. It's these costs are not only squeezing family budgets, they're raising the cost of doing business in Oregon for employers, definitely exacerbating labor and management relations. Wherever you've heard of a lockout or a strike in the last 2 years, it's healthcare costs. And it compounds the budget problems for the state, for school districts, for cities and counties. Now, part of the problem is that we've had fewer employers doing the right thing and providing good benefits to their workers. Now, in our union contracts, we still have more than two-thirds of all workers who enjoy fully paid coverage for themselves and all their dependents. But that's a standard which is eroding. And as that standard erodes, more people go uncovered. And as more people go uncovered, more costs are shift. And the cost of uncompensated care is already costing all of us who have insurance about another 4 or 5% on our premiums. So we need to look at that. We need to, I think, work with employers to help them maintain health benefits for their workers. We have a couple of ideas on the list here. First of all, let's work to get fair prices for prescription drugs. Let me give you a sense of the magnitude of this problem. We did some rough calculations. You're hearing about the PERS crisis. Everybody recognizes this. Crisis because of the increase in cost for PERS. $182 million in the next biennium for the state's general fund, including money that flows to school districts. Well, we're looking at the money the state spends for prescription drugs, over $1 billion a biennium for Oregon Health Plan, for inmates, for patients in the mental health facilities, for its own workers, and add another $150 million to that, and you trace the money that flows to school districts that pays for the salaries and benefits of workers in our school districts. So probably looking at the projected cost increases for prescription drugs over the next 2 years, the state, if it maintained what it's doing now, would be paying about $380 million more in the next biennium just to meet the cost of the increased cost, the increment for prescription drugs, twice the magnitude of the cost increase from PERS. So when I'm not trying to downplay the PERS problem, and you'll see we address it here later on, and that's actually for another committee to deal with, but we're saying if that's such a crisis, so too is the healthcare cost crisis, and in particular the prescription drug cost crisis. And this has got great potential for us to work between labor and management and the public sector and the private sector combined to pool our efforts to find ways to get better prices on prescription drugs, because this, by the way, is an industry and a market which is particularly sensitive to the size of the buyer. The bigger you are, the better the price you get. So we combine our efforts here, we can do a lot to control prescription drug costs, which will help control health care costs, which will help our employers and help our workers. We would also like to look for ways in which to get more employers to do the right thing and provide coverage, and if that is needed by addressing a mandate for health care for all children. This is nothing as aggressive as what was on the ballot and called Measure 23 last November. We didn't support that either because of its huge cost. But, you know, for a very modest payroll tax of about 1.75% paid by all employers in the state, we could fully fund health care for all children in Oregon under the age of 21. Perhaps that's something we should look at. And then, by the way, we wouldn't have the
competitive disadvantages of some workers providing that benefit, some employers providing that benefit for their workers' dependents, and others not. Everybody's talking about another problem in Oregon.
Excuse me, Representative Merkley.
Thank you. Could you repeat that figure that you just gave us on fully funding?
1.75% of payroll.
It's
on page 7.
Okay. Thank you.
If I can go on, again, I don't want to take up too much time this morning, but obviously we know we have a problem in Oregon, embarrassment, the high rate of hunger. We're the state which for 3 years running has had the highest rate of hunger and food insecurity. A big part of that is because of the number of unemployed we have. A lesser but still significant contributor is the fact that for many low-wage working families, they can't afford to keep food on the table. 30% of jobless families are called food insecure. 14% of working adults live in households where food insecurity was a problem in 2001. Obviously, the minimum wage increase approved by the voters will help in one way to address this problem. So too will providing extended and better benefits for the unemployed. We want to call your attention to the fact that in your first special session, you approved an extension of unemployment benefits and a temporary increase in unemployment benefits. That temporary increase, by the way, expired. The extension was never used because the feds then approved a similar extension, and that preempted. So two things to keep in mind. As of the end of December, because of workers falling off of benefits after, in some cases, as many as 65 weeks, and because the $20 a week ceased to be paid, that's $3.5 million less per week, starting at the end of December, paid to jobless families, which is also $3.5 million less per week being spent in the retail establishments and grocery stores of our local communities. Remember, there's two reasons for our unemployment system: help jobless families and stabilize our economy. And on that front, we just took a $3.5 million per week hit at the end of December. So I would call your attention to the fact that in the bill that was approved in the first special session last year, the $29 million for extended benefits was never spent. It's still sitting in the fund. That fund is still quite healthy, $1.6 billion, only down slightly from where it was at the start of last year. We would ask that you look to use that $29 million to reauthorize what would probably be close to another 13 weeks of extended benefits over and beyond for instance, the 6,000 workers who just lost their benefits at the end of December. Even with the federal extension, we had 6,000 workers. And that number is growing by 2,000 a month almost. That will help those families, help those workers until they find work. It will help our economy. And, by the way, will help reduce hunger, at least keep it from getting any worse.
Representative Kitts.
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that figure? And if I'm having a hard time hearing. Representative Merkley.
$29 million from the state's own unemployment insurance trust fund was authorized almost a year ago and never used. Not yet used.
Thank you.
Okay.
Pages.
We also would ask you to look at extending unemployment insurance benefits to part-timers who are available for part-time work. Right now, if you're a part-timer, your employer pays into the system for you. But then if you're laid off, unless you say, hey, I'm ready to work full-time, which in many cases, because of perhaps child care obligations, a woman often can't do, or other family circumstances, women and men can't often be available for full-time work. Unless available for full-time work, you're not entitled to benefits. Your employer is paid into the system for you, but you don't qualify because you're not available for full-time work. Even though you suffered a layoff, you're looking for part-time work, you have that burden on your family budget having lost your job. We under the heading of expanding economic opportunity, a quick story here from the Seattle Times. It's not in my report. I'm off the top of my head. December 13th, Seattle Times documented the story of Amazon.com, a successful, not yet profitable company based in Seattle, which decided to locate in Seattle some 4 years ago, I believe it was. Even though the tax structure in Washington State taxes business through a gross receipts tax, whether or not they're profitable. So as a result, Amazon.com made the decision to locate in Seattle as a startup. They've had, they're a growing business. They paid $4 million in taxes to Washington State. If they had located in Oregon, they would have paid because they're not profitable, $25 a year, I think, is the minimum business tax. $4 million versus $25 a year. And they were shown those two situations and asked why, with that tax contrast, they would have chosen to locate in Seattle, and they said it was the workforce there. The educated workforce in Seattle, in particular, workers trained in software development. So just to point out that it's workforce which often drives the availability of skilled and knowledgeable workers in a particular sector, which often drives businesses' decisions to locate and expand rather than the tax structure. And we think we need to be a lot more competitive with our workforce training programs, in addition to needing a high-quality K-16 education system. Another example, we failed to get this Danish wind turbine manufacturing company, Vestas, to locate in North Portland, right? Economic development incentives were offered. Fine. I don't think, did enough on the workforce development side to say we could move some training funds. We did some. We made some offers. But if we had been able to do more in terms of offering to retrain, let's say, laid off machinists and sheet metal workers whose skills are pretty well in sync with the kind of workforce that company would need, we could have perhaps put together a more attractive package. Now, other factors drove that company's decision, including the federal energy tax credits, but we just think that that's an example of how we need to do more on the workforce development front to spend our money more strategically and link it more wisely to economic development incentives. And I think transition team that I'm still working on workforce development for the governor will be addressing this, and we'll be bringing some recommendations forward, we hope, in the next couple of months.
Thank you. We are running out of time, so if you could take the next 5 minutes to finish, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. I would just, again, like to, under point five, reinforce what you heard from Commissioner Gardner about the need to have basic labor standards and enforce them. One threat, I think, one potential point of conflict we may have in this session is over the question of whether a worker is a worker or an independent contractor. We believe that definition is well established in state and federal law. It's important to treat workers as workers and to give them minimum standards, protect their standards on the job. And if there are attempts made to redefine workers as other than workers, you're going to be hearing strong opposition from us. Finally, I do want to quote for you one of my favorite financial page stories from the Oregonian from several years ago as follows, quote, "Economists across the spectrum agree turning a non-union job into a union job probably will have a bigger effect on lifetime finances than all the advice employees ever will read about investing in 401k plans, buying a home, or otherwise making more of what they earn." So we would hope that you understand that it takes more than a strong economy to deliver good jobs. It takes an organized voice and advocacy for workers. We would like to see a situation in which the state says it's inappropriate to use public funds to oppose a union. Those funds are to be used to provide services, and often among your contractors, an inordinate amount of money is spent opposing the free choice of workers to organize and bargain collectively. We would also like you to take a look at, in the case of a lockout, where workers are locked out by their employers. The law is so complicated now that in some cases workers qualify for unemployment benefits, in many cases they don't. And we would like a much cleaner, even more even-handed approach here, so that if workers are locked out involuntarily by their employer, they qualify for unemployment benefits. As simple as that. The other points on our list here probably are more for the committees like your Revenue Committee or Ways and Means Committees. We are committed to making government less expensive and more efficient. We'd like you to recognize that. That includes responsible reforms to the PERS system, which we'll be dealing with probably most often in Representative Canopus Committee. And finally, we'd just like to bring to your attention that we were proud sponsors of what became Measure 26 on the ballot in last November's election, which got more votes than any other measure on the ballot. It will, we believe, help restore integrity to our initiative process. There'll be other reforms which will be coming forward, probably many of them backed by both business and labor. And so we'd hope you would keep an open mind about those reforms as well, because there is more that needs to be done to make that process more responsive and accountable to the voters. And with that, I know I've taken a lot of your time, and I appreciate your time, and I've given you a lot to look at, and I'm sure you'll be hearing
pieces of this from me as bills come up for your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Nesbitt. I appreciate all the work that you've done on this packet. It's going to be very helpful to those 16 pages. Very complete and concise. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, do we have time for one quick question?
We do have one other group and three people signed up.
Madam Chair, I'd like to point out that you denied my question.
Yes, I did. I'll tell you what, if Mr. Nesbitt, would you be willing to stay until the other group has testified?
Yes, I would.
For questions?
Happy to do
that. Okay, Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors National Association, Steve Rose.
Actually, I think IBEW.
Oh, he is. I'm sorry. So they're not here?
Yeah, they're not here.
Okay, I'm sorry. It is IBEW.
Sure, I'm not.
Madam Chairman, committee members, I'm going to speak to you just briefly this morning, and I'm probably going to cross boundaries with some issues that may not necessarily be before this committee, but certainly you'll be voting on in the coming session. So I'd like to start out by introducing myself. For the record, my name is Steve Rose. I'm business manager for IBEW, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 280. I represent approximately 1,100 workers in 9 counties. Our jurisdiction pretty much runs through the center of the Willamette Valley, starting in Woodburn, going through Cottage Grove, and I also represent Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson counties in Central Oregon. We have approximately 4 or 5 collective bargaining agreements that cover electrical workers in various trade groups. As we speak today, we're experiencing about 25% unemployment in my local union. That's not the bad news. The bad news is we started that about a year before the Portland metro area felt that effect. So we are, in essence, going into our 4th year of those kinds of unemployment numbers, substantial, even by construction building trade standards. One of the things that everyone's spoken about earlier is the apprenticeship programs and the jobs that we do, and I'd like to offer that our $3.2 million investment in our training center located in Tangent is on par with what the other groups have said, so I won't repeat their statements other than to offer up something that nobody's mentioned, and that is with the current situation and the amount of employment available, you are seeing a real true drain of skilled workers from the state. And that may in the long run be a lot more serious than the unemployment that we're currently experiencing. And I say that because there aren't a lot of places to go to work right now. We're a very mobile workforce, but you've got to have some opportunities. And if a person ends up in Boston, which some of my members have, and the work picture remains good there, they're not coming back. And so while we have some of the best apprenticeship programs in the nation, in the state of Oregon, because we have license laws to support that, we're losing those folks, and I'm afraid we're not going to see all of them return. That's a serious issue that is going to bite us a little bit later down the road, but it's coming. Briefly, I attended the economic summit held in Portland, and while I think some of the ideas presented there had some merit, I've got to be honest with you, I walked out of there scared as hell. If those people and those 13 white papers that they presented are going to set the course for Oregon, we're all in deep trouble. They see the future as being that of Oregon being an R&D, highly skilled state. The reality is you're not going to employ very many people, and you're not even going to make up for the loss of jobs by transferring that. Is it a good idea? Yeah, but it's got a lot of merit. I'd love to see U of O, Oregon State, and all our universities become the leader in training people for those. Great. It's not going to help this economy, and it's not going to do a lot for this state. If you want to stimulate this economy, you need to put people to work. People that earn wages and live paycheck to paycheck spend their money. And I don't care how many tax breaks you give a business, that's not going to put money directly into the economy as quick as providing a job for somebody. On that particular issue, which is one of my big ones for me personally, I think it's unconscionable to give a tax break or expend public funds where you don't also put some conditions on the expenditure of those funds. And I'll give you a great example. There were 10 people running through the halls of this very building in the last couple of years touting that they were going to build cogeneration facilities in Oregon. And it was almost a foregone conclusion that they were going to get a tax break for doing so. The question I guess I asked early on was, why? There's more money in the construction of that facility in the first 18 months than they're going to put into the economy of Oregon in the next 25 years by the employment of those people that operate that facility. I'm going to say that one more time. There's more money going into the economy of the state of Oregon in the 18 months that that's under construction than there is in 25 years of wages paid to the workers that operate it. So in order to get that tax incentive for 3 or 5 years, they've got to maintain a certain level of employment of those workers. But I would offer up that it's a back-assward situation and not one we should be looking at. What we should be doing is we should be saying, if you're going to come in and ask us for a tax break, then the people that you employ in the 18 months of construction should be paid living wage jobs. You should have an apprenticeship program in place. You should have health care for the workers that are working in this facility. That's where we should be making the commitment, because those people are going to dump that money in that 18-month period. And instead what we see companies that are coming into the state of Oregon. They're bringing their workers in from out of state, typically from the southeast United States where wages are considerably lower. So a guy that's earning $12 in Georgia would love to come to Oregon for $16 and has no qualms about leaving his family and coming for the duration of that project. The truth of the matter is that job may be a $22 or $24 or $30 an hour job in Oregon. So they're undercutting by, in some cases, 50% the wages that should be paid. They've got workers that are tickled to be here. They're sending all the money home to mama, and they're not taking care of business, and it's not helping stimulate Oregon's economy. And I throw in the enterprise zones on a whole. I'm not against enterprise zones per se. We have some examples that Chairman Close would be familiar with in Albany-Tangent area. Target Warehouses came in, built a rather large facility, employed people, got a tax break, well-deserved. Good jobs, not great paying, but good wages for Linn County. But we have mills in Albany that are grandfathering onto a grandfather onto a grandfather of an enterprise zone. They're not producing any more jobs. They're not providing any more employment opportunities. And we gave them a $12 million tax break in Linn County. That's atrocious in my mind. So I'll throw out one more thing. Revenues as collected in this last biennium were 41 cents of each dollar. They were 45 cents of each dollar in the previous biennium. That 4 cent difference is the amount of the enterprise zone tax credits in this state. And it's also the amount of the budget shortfalls that you're currently looking at. So next time somebody comes before you, either through this committee or other committees, and starts touting how they're going to jumpstart the economy and how it's absolute necessity that they get an enterprise zone or a tax credit to locate here, I want to tell you something, that those people are laughing themselves sick when they walk out of this building, because it's not, despite what they're going to tell you, their decision to locate here because of a tax credit. And if you could sit in their boardrooms and listen to what's being said, they will admit that to you, and they'll admit that to you in private on occasion. What they're looking at is the skilled workforces that are available, the quality of living, the ability to expand, and the cost of power. Those are the things that generate construction, and those are the things that generate people deciding where they're going to locate. Oregon's got to stop being easy. You know, we're the cheap chick on the corner when it comes to these tax issues. I hate to put it that way, but we're willing to let ourselves go way too cheap. We've got way too much to offer businesses to allow that to happen. And it's hurting the workers of this state in the end.
Sure. Representative Merkley.
Thank you. You've commented on what companies think about when they're locating. Recently, there have been a number of articles in the national press about Oregon's economic circumstances, and in particular the very short school year that we have here in public schools. Is the ability to come to Oregon and have your workers have public schools for their children that have a full year a significant element in decisions to locate? Or to put it differently, is this national press about our school year hurting us in recruiting international business or business?
Madam Chair, Representative Berkeley, I don't think construction workers often. Are you asking about the workers themselves, sir, or the businesses?
You spoke of the boardrooms of people making decisions about the location.
I think the boardrooms are making decisions based on that, and I guess I would, you know, as a personal aside, I think it's absolutely unconscionable that we can't figure out how to fund K-12 education in the state. I mean, it strikes me as almost bizarre.
Steve, will you go through, you said the decisions that a company would make would be based on, it was five things. Would you repeat what you said? You said energy costs?
Madam Chair, I don't know if I could paraphrase them exactly, because as you well know, once I get on a roll, it just kind of flows. But I think that quality of living, availability of land for future expansion, education of the workforce, cost of power available to them. How am I doing? How many is that?
Mm-hmm. That's four. That's probably what it was.
Well, there may have been a fifth one in there, but I'm sorry, I can't recall what it was.
Okay, please continue.
I think that pretty much concludes my remarks, other than to tell you that from my members' standpoint, we are becoming a society of serfs and kings. Middle-class America is going away for us, and I don't want to come to you and preach gloom and doom, because we're good wage earners in the trade that I'm in. But unless we figure out something in Oregon that replaces the manufacturing jobs lost with something other than service-related jobs where we're changing beds, vacuuming floors, flipping hamburgers, we've got a problem. And I wish I had an answer for you to what that was, but that is very much on the radar screens of the people I represent. They're very concerned about that. That concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Amen.
Thank you. Representative Shoffler.
It's more of a comment, sir, than anything. Thanks for coming. I'm not opposed to tax credits and enterprise zones if they do create jobs and help our economy. But I look at this kind of thing as an investment that we are making in these businesses for the benefit of our community. Now, I frequently hear run government like a business. There's not one businessman or woman on Wall Street that would make an investment in a business unless they truly believed and after time saw a decent return on that investment. That's what I want out of these things, and the returns you spelled out. Good paying jobs, and yes, some revenue to this state. And that's the kind of return I want, because I do look at us as a board of trustees of a corporation, for example, and we're handling people's money when we make these investments, and I want that kind of return that you spelled out for us when we do make these investments.
Representative Garrard.
And Madam Chair, I'll make this short because I know we're pressed for time. But Steve, I've been involved in economic development in my own community for 30 years, and I honestly think you make a mistake when you do not include the competitive process in recruiting new business to our state. I think that's a very important part of the formula. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in the straits we're in now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your comments.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, committee members.
I just want to read off those that have signed up. We're not sure they're still here. Is Ernie Williams still here? Herman Later? Or Steve Willey? Ramon Ramez? Okay, I think they were here on the workers, on the minimum wage issue. So, we have about 7 minutes. Mr. Nesbitt, will you rejoin us? And I can't remember who had their hand up.
I
was it Diane?
I think.
Representative Kitts,
I will yield.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Tim, I wanted to ask you about the unemployment benefits extension, because clearly it seems like of everything you've talked about, that may be the most immediate crisis that we're facing with, you know, this many workers losing benefits already and then piling onto that. How quickly could we restart an extension for those people whose benefits have expired? Do you know, are we poised to just pass a bill with an emergency clause and get that up and running immediately if we were...
Chair Close and Representative Rosenbaum, that could be done. We have a bill draft still in the works. You could, with a bill with an emergency clause, get it done fairly quickly. As I said, a lot of people heard about the federally authorized extensions, thinking that took care of the problem, when in fact By the end of December, there were 6,000 workers who had gotten all the way through, even the extended benefits provided by the federal extensions. And there's another 450 a week, according to the Employment Department, who are kind of falling off after the maximum of 65 weeks, some shorter than that, depending on the length of their work experience prior to being laid off. So 6,000 workers growing at 2,000 a month. Those are the workers who, I don't know what's happening to them right now. I mean, and what they face, what they and their families face, how many will leave the state, how many will, you know, suffer through, and how long it will take them to find work. Up to now, it's been a jobless recovery, to the extent we've seen any recovery, and so that's the problem. It's the group of long-term unemployed who are the challenge right now, and putting that $29 million to work would probably, for that group, buy at least a 13-week extension, pay for a 13-week extension through the next 6 months.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I just would hope that as that bill comes through, that this committee would be able to take a look at it and do so quickly, because I think that would make a real difference in our economy and help a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Very good figures that you presented. We will follow up on that. Representative Kitts.
Thank you for taking the time, and I pass you a note hoping that you will please call me and set up a point.
I have a ton of questions
I'd like to ask you, and I'm not going to bore the committee. However, I would like two questions. Number one, it says here a single worker now needs to earn $11.05 per hour to meet basic needs. I realize this is a two-year-old document, the one titled Northwest Job Gap Study.
Yes.
Can I ask what formula you use, or whomever put this together uses, to derive at that number?
Chair Close and Representative Kitts, if you look at page 12 of that document.
Oh, I always forget the reading part.
They itemize food and housing and transportation and health care and child care, and they show the different family sizes. And those are the components of the calculation right there.
Okay. I just want to also point out that the numbers on the bottom there don't reflect the numbers on the front. So that's what was a little confusing for me. I didn't know if the front press release had been updated from the data that was provided, is why I asked that. Second of all, I would like you to run an initiative next time. We'll title it Measure One, we'll organize the legislature, and I'd be more than happy to make $11.05 an hour for our service down here. I'd be happy to make half that per hour at this point.
But you don't get minimum wage. Yeah.
So, and my other questions I can reserve for our meeting when you're able to set that up. I have plenty of time today if you're available.
Okay, I'll try and do that. Thank you.
Further questions?
Oh, another question.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tim, I wanted to ask you kind of the same question that I asked Mr. Rose. That is, to what degree is publicity about our education system hurting our economy here in Oregon, our ability to attract new business?
Chair Close and Representative Merkley, it can't help. It's hard to quantify the toll it's taking, but I think it's tarnishing the image of Oregon, turning what was a positive in the past in the eyes of businesses seeking to locate in our state into a negative. I think, time will tell. This is the kind of thing you see play out over some number of years, but I think immediate, effective, affirmative action to turn around these problems is hopefully going to offset some of the bad publicity. But I am worried about cumulative effect here, which will be hard to overcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
And Representative Merkley, if I could comment. You know, I think that a lot of the push and pull you see in education, when the union apprentice places have to teach algebra, that's a problem. And so we have to demand accountability for the money we spend for education, that those guys, when they walk in, can be expected to know some algebra.
Yeah.
It's a problem.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'd been struck recently, several corporate executives who told me that their firm wouldn't consider expanding in Oregon and wouldn't have located in Oregon as long as we have, quote, the shortest year in the country. And it's just, I realize how so many different elements are interwoven in terms of our ability to be successful as a state. And I was interested in the perspective of the union side from the corporate side that I've been hearing. Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. Nesbitt?
Well, we're about 2 minutes early, so thank you so much for your patience. Thanks, everyone. And we are adjourned.